Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, October 23rd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's look at today's weather forecast first thing. Showers will likely continue through Monday morning, so you might need a rain jacket or an umbrella on your trip to work or school. However, the clouds and showers should clear from the area by Monday afternoon, leaving behind plenty of sunshine. After Monday, the work week looks fairly wet, with on and off showers and a few thunderstorms possible Tuesday through next weekend. The warmest day of the week will be on Tuesday, with the highs in the 70s. Otherwise, temperatures will be in the 50s and 60s through Saturday. The first article we're going to read from the front page of the Courier is titled, Navigator CO2 Nixes Multi-State Pipeline. The unpredictable nature of regulatory process is blamed. Our story was written by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. One of the three carbon dioxide pipeline companies that have sought to build in Iowa announced Friday it's canceling its proposal amid the unpredictable nature of the regulatory and government processes of Iowa and South Dakota. Navigator CO2 had proposed to build a more than 1,300-mile pipeline system to transport captured carbon dioxide from ethanol plants and other facilities in five states to Illinois for underground sequestration or other commercial purposes. The bulk of that system was planned for Iowa. In September, the company suffered a setback in South Dakota when the state's Public Utilities Commission denied it a permit, partly because its route did not conform with county ordinances that restrict the placement of such pipelines. Navigator then asked the state utility regulators in Iowa to suspend its permit process while it awaited a decision from Illinois regulators. Less than 2 weeks ago, it asked to pull its permit application in Illinois. Quote, as good stewards of capital and responsible managers of people, we have made the difficult decision to cancel the Heartland Greenway project, unquote. Navigator's chief executive, Matt Vining, said in a project update posted to the company's website on Friday, quote, we are disappointed that we will not be able to provide services to our customers and thank them for their continued support, unquote. Pipeline regulations vary from state to state and by type of pipeline, which was challenging to maneuver, said Elizabeth Burns Thompson, a spokesperson for the company. Quote, there's also been significant discussion at the legislative level in each state about possible changes to their state-level processes in light of these proposed projects, creating even more uncertainty about what the future may hold, she said. Navigator hadn't filed a motion to withdraw its permit request in Iowa as of Friday morning, according to the Iowa Utilities Board documents. Burns Thompson said Navigator signed option agreements for easements with landowners that will expire after a few years. Quote, this is an historic victory for the people of Iowa, said Jess Mazur of the Sierra Club of Iowa, which had resisted the pipeline proposals. Quote, for 2 years, we've worked relentlessly to protect our homes, families, and communities, unquote. The pipeline projects are meant to capture lucrative federal tax credits for sequestering carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas that is primary driver of climate change. Ethanol plants would benefit from the tax credits and from producing low-carbon fuels that can be sold in stricter markets. Pipeline opponents have argued that the project poses safety risks to residents if they rupture, would damage farmland, and do not serve a public purpose that deserves the use of eminent domain to construct them. The two remaining proposals are by Summit Carbon Solutions and Wolf Carbon Solutions. Summit is nearing the end of its permit process in Iowa, but has had setbacks in the Dakotas. It recently acknowledged that its project, if approved by state regulators, would not likely be in operation until 2026, more than a year after its initial estimate. Summit seeks eminent domain for land easements for about a quarter of its more than 680-mile route in Iowa. In response to Navigator's announcement, Summit said it, quote, welcomes and is well-positioned to add additional plants and communities to our project footprint. Navigator had planned to connect to more than a dozen facilities in Iowa. Wolf Carbon Solutions has said it will not use eminent domain for its comparatively short route in Iowa. About 90 miles of pipe would connect two ethanol plants in eastern Iowa, and their carbon dioxide would be piped to Illinois. A Wolf spokesperson did not immediately respond to a question about the status of that project. Quote, we are going to stop the Summit and Wolf carbon pipelines next, Mazur said. Quote, they will meet resistance at every level in every corner of every state, unquote. Next, we have a story written by Jeff Reinitz titled Defense Challenges Cause of Fatal Fire, Dateline Waterloo. Trial for a man accused of setting a fire that killed his friend in 2022 has been delayed while the defense gathers evidence that may challenge the cause of the fatal blaze. John Walter Spooner, 60, of Denver, is charged with first-degree murder in the death of Tony Lewis Grider, 60. Spooner had been staying at Grider's home at 309 East 2nd Street on August 19, 2022, when an early morning fire broke out. Grider died in his second-floor bedroom. Authorities allege Spooner used gasoline to set a fire on the front porch. He was seen sparking a cigarette lighter before the fire and tossing a gas can into the street shortly before smoke and flames began showing. Defense attorney Nicole Watt said experts hired by the defense have found additional clues to the fire. An expert with the Forensic Fire Analysis Institute determined samples taken from the porch deck don't match the gasoline found in the can, according to court records filed by the defense. And an engineer with Combustion Science and Engineering Incorporated indicates he may have found an alternative location for where the fire started, records state. The defense asked the court to allow testing of blood samples taken by the Iowa Medical Examiner's Office during autopsy in an effort to find traces of hydrogen cyanide. Burning foam cushions can emit poisonous gases, and finding such traces in the samples could point to a furniture fire. Judge David Odekirk ordered the medical examiner's office to preserve any blood samples following a Monday hearing. Trial for the murder case was postponed pending a December hearing. Spooner was convicted of arson in connection with the fire during a November 2022 trial, and sentencing for that charge was also delayed. Now a story filed by Melody Parker. Hearst Center to unveil master plan. Tuesday event will allow public input. Dateline Cedar Falls. The Hearst Center for the Arts will unveil a comprehensive master plan that reimagines how the center will serve future generations at a public open house on Tuesday. The event is from 5 to 7 p.m. at the center, 304 West Searley Boulevard. There will be a brief program, and those in attendance will have the opportunity to view preliminary facility designs and site layout prepared by OPN architects and ask questions of city staff and architects. Quote, this is a look at how we can be right-sized for the next 30 years, said Corey Hurless, cultural program supervisor and Hearst Center director. Quote, this building has served us well for 35 years, but over time, our programming has changed and expanded, and the original layout doesn't allow us space for expansion, unquote. The Hearst Master Plan is designed to provide the framework for successfully implementing a potential construction project or remodeling project to update and expand the facility. In the past few years, public strategic planning sessions have taken place to discuss current details, and future site and infrastructure needs. Significant input was provided by the Cedar Falls Arts and Culture Board, Friends of the Hearst Board, and City of Cedar Falls staff, as well as information drawn from previous public strategic planning sessions. The architectural firm has been working on the plans since spring, including evaluating the cost feasibility of new construction or a remodel expansion. The plan calls for such amenities as 4 classrooms, increased gallery space, a larger lobby, performance hall, and ceramic studio, an artwork storage space with climate-controlled environment, and an elevator large enough to transport large canvases and other artworks, Hurla said. Quote, we need more classroom and workshop space. Performances at May Lotta Hall are almost always full, and I have to stand at the door telling people who drove all the way in from surrounding communities that we're at capacity, she explained. Finally, the building is aging. The HVAC system, the bathrooms, all the systems are needing to be updated or replaced, unquote. A request for qualifications narrative accompanying the plan sums up the city's goal for the center. Quote, the city wishes to develop a plan for a new or improved facility at the current site. The city owns both 224 West Searley Boulevard, the Red House, and 304 West Searley Boulevard. Ideally, the project allows programming to continue during construction. This facility will have flexible spaces designed for easily accessible multi-use programming, artist studios, and focus on supporting and inspiring creativity. Quote, a building that conveys its arts focus enhances its attraction as a destination for the community, residents, and tourists. It also fits in with the predominant residential architecture of the College Hill neighborhood is important. The Hearst Center for the Arts should remain a contributor to the economic fabric of the College Hill neighborhood, unquote. Next, a story written by Jeff Reinitz. Teen faces gun charge, Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo teen has been detained for allegedly firing a gun during an argument with a girl on Wednesday afternoon. Authorities allege the two were involved in an argument around 4:45 p.m. at 1601 West 11th Street. The male then fired a single shot outside and returned to the house, according to police. Officers searched the house and found 2 firearms inside. The alleged shooter, age 17, was charged in juvenile court with reckless use of a firearm and assault while displaying a weapon. No injuries were reported. 3 detained in shooting, Dateline Waterloo. 3 people were detained after gunfire hit a home and a parked vehicle on Wednesday night. Police said 2 teens approached a 3rd teen in the area of the 300 block of East Mullen Avenue around 7:55 p.m. One of the teens started shooting at the victim and then fled. No injuries were reported, but 3 bullets struck a home at 87 Mulberry Street, and another hit the roof of a Ford Flex parked near that address. Police obtained surveillance video that showed the shooter getting into a Dodge Nitro that drove off. Officers pulled over the Dodge a short time later. 2 people were detained inside, and a 3rd attempted to run before being detained. Authorities found 2 firearms in the vehicle. The driver, 20-year-old Keon Demaria Buford of Waterloo, was arrested for intimidation with a weapon for allegedly driving the others to and from the shooting. The 15-year-old male who ran from the vehicle was charged in juvenile court with intimidation with a weapon, reckless use of a firearm, and interference. The 17-year-old male passenger in the vehicle was charged as a juvenile with carrying weapons and possession of marijuana. Here's a story written by Maria Cooper. Rooms for Transformation. New apartments available from Elevate CCBHC for those with severe mental illness. Dateline Waterloo. Individuals who could only go to mental health institutions for long-term care now have the opportunity to live closer to the community. Elevate Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinic unveiled two new downtown apartments for those with intellectual disabilities and severe mental illness, also called an intensive residential support home. The Waterloo Mental Health Center runs one of three such support programs in the state. The others are in Spirit Lake and Burlington. The first floor of the apartment building at 619 Mulberry Street, right next to the Elevate CCBHC's office, is meant to provide very intense support and rehabilitation to the people living there. Project Director Bob Lincoln said, "The two apartments can hold a total of five people. There's a two-bed, two-bathroom space, and a three-bedroom apartment with one handicapped accessible bathroom. Each living space has a comfortable living room and a modern kitchen." Lincoln said potential residents would be referred by a care coordinator when they are not successful in finding a community provider or are stuck in the hospital without the capability of finding support. He noted the facility will help those who have no one willing to take a chance on them, unquote. Once residents arrive, they will be given a specialized plan of care where the clinic workers will understand the needs of the individual and learn what it takes for them to be successful. This would start with a comprehensive assessment to make sure the person is medically stable, and then the medical professionals would identify the underlying mental illness that needs therapy treatment. The clinic workers would then help the individuals to build skills and communicate their needs. Quote, "They'll leave with the community capacity that our provider support services provide to make a successful transition to their lifelong home," Lincoln said. Thomas Cullen, the director of Elevate's peer support system, is a resource for people in the program as someone who has been in their shoes. Cullen was diagnosed with clinical depression in his early teens and used drugs and alcohol on and off to cope. He hit his breaking point at age 47, and that is when he told his psychiatrist the truth for the first time in 30 years. He said a lot of darkness for the first 3 years of his life has now turned into light, and he is able to help people who needed what he needed. He thinks the new apartments would have been life-changing for him. Quote, "I could have been the guy staying here if I would have kept going like I was going," he said. Lincoln said the building is different from the Adult Crisis Stabilization Center located on West Dunkerton Road because that facility is for short-term stays. He called the new apartments a long-term behavioral support setting. Quote, "People can stay a few weeks, a few months, and maybe even years if necessary," he said. "But they have the assurance that they will have housing and they will have the support they need." The living spaces were made possible by a $350,000 grant from the Blackhawk County Gaming Association and a $500,000 grant from County Social Services. Alice Shirley, president of the BHCGA board, said the association loves to give out grants for something transformative. Quote, "As I listen to Lincoln describe what this facility will provide, I think about the personal empowerment and transformation of precious human beings who so very often get overlooked in our communities," Shirley said. "To think that they might find their forever home outside of an institution and become contributing, vital members to our community is so deeply transformational," unquote. Lincoln said he and a group of stakeholders were part of a statewide discussion on how to help people who were stuck in psychiatric units, jails, or on the streets. Closure of the mental health institutes in Clarinda and Mount Pleasant in 2015, as well as the upcoming closure of the Glenwood Resource Center in 2024, will leave only two MHIs remaining, one in Independence and the other Cherokee. Lincoln said when these institutions close and people are moved into the community, many of the local resources can't provide the same level of care. He said Elevate is trying to replicate those services with the new apartments and support center, bringing resources to those who need them without forcing the clients to be institutionalized. The housing will also stop those living in the community from being sent out of state for their care because there's not enough space for them locally. Quote, "This is just an evolution of bringing capacity to the community," Lincoln said. Quote, "So again, people don't have to leave the community to be supported and served." Andy Malone wrote this next story. Cedar Falls Council repeals College Hill plan. Dateline Cedar Falls. A city council majority went forward Monday with repealing the College Hill visionary plan for future growth, development, and improvements. The move came despite a fury of public protests from stakeholders, including University of Northern Iowa President Mark Nook and College Hill Partnership Board President Hannah Chrisman. As of Friday afternoon, Mayor Rob Green was still considering a veto. He can do so within 14 days of passage. Quote, "I will take into account the comments from the university and College Hill Partnership," said Green, immediately following the lengthy discussion. The council voted 4-3 to withdraw the Imagine College Hill plan, approved on May 3, 2021, after council members Daryl Cruz, Susan DeBurr, Dave Sires, and Dustin Ganfeld recommended earlier this month the previous endorsement be removed from the record. Council members Kelly Dunn, Simon Harding, and Gil Schultz voted against rescinding the plan developed under the advisement of Farrell Madden, now Jeffrey Farrell of Washington, D.C., a consultant hired by the city. The council also scheduled a committee meeting for November 6th to come up with a new version of the plan focused on a smaller area. Nook said there's no urgent need to take action on aspects of the plan. Quote, "This is an area that has caused concerns for some of our parents of some of our students, and having it revitalized is important," Nook said. "Repealing this plan means starting over," unquote. A veto would be Green's first in 2023. His last was in December. He vetoed an ordinance that would have reduced the council voting threshold from a 5-member supermajority to a 4-member simple majority for overriding Planning and Zoning Commission decisions on zoning code amendments. It came as the majority was attempting to adopt amendments to what were new downtown zoning rules. Cruz, DeBurr, and Sires were all on the council at the time the College Hill plan was passed in 2021. DeBurr argued Monday the area covered by the plan is too large and wants to eliminate areas not even part of the hill, in her mind. The plan covers a swath of territory south of 12th Street and north of Surly Boulevard, between Iowa Highway 57 and Hudson Road. A smaller subsection also exists south of University Avenue and the UNI campus. She asked the council to focus on the areas where she feels most everyone wants to see revitalization, the multiple residence R4 and commercial C3 districts on the current zoning map, encompassing the Hill Business District and small northern residential area up to 19th Street, and a southern strip west of College Street down to University Avenue. Council member Dave Sires was previously adamant about narrowing in on areas 1, 2, and 3 in the current visioning plan. That is a little bit larger than what's covered by the C3 and R4 areas, but in the same vicinity. The council had already paused implementation of the plan and removed funding for new zoning initiatives, which the minority brought up in its argument against repeal. Council member Simon Harding pushed for moving forward with the plan and then choosing aspects everyone agrees should be implemented. However, the majority doesn't want to be in a position again where it appears the opportunity was missed to make significant changes. They felt that was the case after a downtown visioning plan was adopted and new zoning code was crafted and approved in the 2021 under a different council. That's why, close to 2 years ago, a majority of the council initially favored a building permit moratorium in the downtown commercial areas. What council members wanted and eventually got was a recommendation to repeal the downtown zoning. It never happened, though, because Ganfield split from the other three. He noted at the time, making changes to the new code would be more productive. In addition, he had not heard from enough people interested in the full repeal. Quote, form-based coding approach is based on traditional American town and city form and function, creating places that are inherently pedestrian-friendly and mixed use. We operate under the guiding philosophy that the great neighborhoods, towns, and cities in America did not happen by accident. They were planned with a physical vision, states Farrell Madden on its home page. Among the downtown changes debated and voted on have been parking requirements and the use of vinyl siding. They also include the elimination of the public process for site plan review because the code has been described as more black and white. Quote, the codes are not written in the abstract, but rather to produce a specific place, one envisioned by the local citizens and grounded in the reality of the local economic, political, and community context, states the company. All changes to zoning directly affect new construction and certain expansion projects. Harding also noted an election is right around the corner and recommended the next council and mayor take up the matter in 2024. Green agrees with that statement, another reason he's giving thought to a veto. Sires, DeBurr, Harding, and Green all have terms expiring at the end of the year and are not seeking re-election. In other business, the council did the following things. They held a public swearing-in ceremony for a new police dog, Buna, Cedar Falls' first canine officer in 20 years, and they approved a $450,000 agreement with Strand Associates of Madison, Wisconsin, for planning and preliminary design services at its wastewater treatment plant in advance of major upgrades. And they approved agreements with Kubica Corporation on land conveyance and a partial tax exemption to allow the company to move forward with constructing new facilities in the city's industrial park as part of the move to make Cedar Falls its headquarters. And lastly, they authorized the acquisition of easements and fee titles from 36 properties in advance of the reconstructions of the West Viking Road from Union Road to Production Drive, as well as the North Cedar Heights area along Woodlawn Drive and East Woodridge Drive to Greenwood Avenue. The West Viking Road project includes improvements all the way down to Hudson Road corridor. Ganfield dissented to the North Cedar Heights acquisitions in the 6-1 vote. Miller Meeks receives death threats for vote. Iowa U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, a Republican, withdrew her support for Ohio Representative Jim Jordan for Speaker of the House on Wednesday, voting instead for Representative Kay Granger of Texas. Miller Meeks said she received, quote, credible death threats after voting against Jordan, and that she had reported them to the authorities. Miller Meeks joined nearly two dozen Republicans who voted against Jordan, denying him the gavel on his second attempt to clinch the position. Jordan, the hard-right co-founder of the Freedom Caucus, had attempted to whip votes to replace ousted former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, a Republican from California, but a coalition of moderate Republicans opposed his candidacy, meaning he could not muster the support of more than half of the House of Representatives to become Speaker. Hinson calls to end gridlock. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson joined a growing chorus of Republicans calling to grant broad powers to the temporary House Speaker, Patrick McHenry, to end a gridlock after weeks with no Speaker of the House. McHenry currently can only oversee votes for Speaker while the seat remains vacant, and he cannot guide legislation without a change in the rules. And now, listeners, we'd just like to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, October 23rd, on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, this announcement.
Kate fell in love with her husband after one date, and with her son after one look, and she risked it all by trying meth just one time. Meth never, ever. Visit yourlifeiowa.org, brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
Now let's turn to the opinion section. Our first article comes from the Des Moines Register and was written by Brooklyn Drazy. University of Northern Iowa gets largest gift in its history. How will it be used? The University of Northern Iowa will use a $25 million gift, the largest in the university's history, to fund initiatives and support students as they study at the newly named David W. Wilson College of Business. UNI President Mark Nook on Friday announced the gift, given by Wilson Automotive Group, owner and CEO David Wilson, and unveiled the College of Business's new name. It is the first college in the university to be named for a person. Quote, "This is a historic moment for our campus. The Wilson College of Business will truly transform business education at UNI, taking our already premier business programs to new heights," Nook said in a news release. "We're honored that UNI's first named college will stand as a testament to David's belief in the power of education and will provide resources for the university to foster initiative for the future," unquote. Wilson, who graduated from UNI in 1970 with a degree in religion and philosophy and a minor in business, helms a car sales chain in California, Arizona, Nevada, and Mexico. He said he hopes this gift will present itself as a philosophical defense of capitalism. "Ethical capitalism needs all the help it can get these days," he said, as businesses are being blamed for every problem in global economics. He made his contribution to UNI's Our Tomorrow fundraising campaign as a challenge gift with the goal of generating more support for ethics-based education at the university. The campaign has reached $243 million of its $250 million goal. Quote, "It's our hope this contribution will foster instruction that reveals the importance of maintaining ethical principles in the corporate environment at all levels, from daily operations to executive decisions, and will promote tactful and tactical rational thinking required to defend successful companies from ideological attacks," Wilson said at the announcement. The gift will be used to establish the Wilson Endowment for Integrity and Excellence to further ethics education in the College of Business and across campus in partnership with the Department of Philosophy and Religion, College of Business Dean Leslie Wilson said. It also established a scholarship for students coming to UNI from Tama County, where David Wilson grew up. One eligible student each year will receive a renewing scholarship that will fill the monetary gap in tuition, room and board payments after other scholarships have been applied. With these funds, the business college will be able to continue its work in preparing students for an ever-changing business world, while leaving space for innovation, such as incorporating AI into classrooms and offices, the university said. Quote, "Our students are the leaders of tomorrow," Leslie Wilson said. "We're looking at students today who are future CEOs, who are future business owners, who are individuals who may be in the healthcare profession or social work, or teachers, that every day have the opportunity to do what is right. But to do that, they need the critical thinking skills. They need the ethical reasoning that allows them to do that and allows them to build upon and live the values that Iowa is known to have. Unquote. Next is a piece written by the publisher of the Storm Lake Times Pilot, John Cullen, and it is titled, At Age 73, I'm a Swiftie. I saw Taylor Swift's blockbuster concert movie Friday night in northern Indiana. We were there visiting our daughter Bridget, her husband Brandon, and their dog Wrigley. I hadn't planned on going, but I'd heard so much about the Swift phenomenon, I figured I'd tag along with the girls and see for myself. I thought the movie might be a documentary, behind-the-scenes sort of her sold-out Eras Tour concerts. Instead, it was a 3-hour, start-to-finish concert movie. Half the screens in the 16 Auditorium movie complex were showing the movie on Saturday night, and they were all nearly full. They were mostly teenage girls, but a fair number of old geezers like myself wanted to see what all the fuss is about. Tickets cost $19.89 the year Swift was born for general admission, while senior citizens got in for $13.13. 13 is Swift's lucky number. The movie set box office records for the first weekend with $100 million in ticket sales. Demand was huge because millions of Taylor's fans were unable to get tickets to the live concerts across North America, and also for people like Bridget, who was lucky enough to attend the Swift concert in Chicago's Soldier Field, vast football stadium, and wanted to relive the experience. The Swift phenomenon has gained more traction in recent weeks, as she's been seen at Kansas City Chiefs football games, watching her latest boyfriend, Travis Kelce, catch touchdown passes. I did not see either of them at the movie. As in her live concerts, Swift performs nonstop in the movie for 3 hours, including about a dozen costume changes that seem to happen in the blink of an eye. I didn't know the words to any of her songs, but everyone else in the theater seemed to, and sang right along with Taylor. Many dressed like Taylor, wore her merch, and ate popcorn out of Taylor Swift's souvenir buckets sold at the concession stand. The movie was filmed during one of her concerts at the SoFi Football Stadium in Los Angeles, early August. It's amazing the movie could be produced and released so quickly. The camera work and sound are incredible. It's a first-rate concert film. It's a long way from the old standard Woodstock of my generation, which chronicled the 1969 Counterculture Music Festival that attracted 400,000 devotees to a muddy farm field in upper New York State. For people who criticize me for attending a Taylor Swift movie, I just shake it off. Now, from the Des Moines Register, we have Joni Ernst can bring down drug prices for Iowans in government spending package. Written by Cheryl Wisenand. Note, Cheryl Wisenand is a former co-chair of the Polk County Republican Party and recently served multiple terms in the Iowa Board of Pharmacy. Every day, Iowans rely on prescription drugs to live their lives, but the sticker shock they feel at the pharmacy is a hard pill to swallow. For years, drug prices in America have made it harder for Iowans to make ends meet every day and force us to choose between paying the electric bill or buying life-saving medication. The new drug law passed last year will help many people, but there is more to be done. Our elected leaders must finally offer all patients and consumers some relief. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, Americans pay roughly 2 times more for their prescription drugs than people in other nations, with copays and out-of-pocket prices reaching further and further into our wallets. This is a problem on a massive scale, as the Kaiser Family Foundation reports that more than 6 in 10 Americans take at least one prescription regularly, and more than 8 in 10 feel that drug prices are unreasonable. This crisis has been spiraling for years. One of the primary factors contributing to this problem is that our prescription drug market is becoming increasingly anti-competitive. When drug companies develop a new treatment, patent law dictates that they get a certain amount of time for that product to enjoy exclusivity on the market. After that exclusivity period ends, competitors are allowed to develop lower-cost generic and biosimilar drugs that are just as effective at treating a condition as the original product, but often come at significantly lower prices to patients. However, brand-name drug companies have mastered the art of manipulating patent monopolies to extend the amount of time that their products, and only their products, are available. They use tactics like slightly altering drug formulas to secure a new patent, paying off competitors to delay entry of competing products, or securing a frivolous amount of patents to lengthen their window of exclusivity. These tactics represent abuse of monopolies, and they are a leading contributor to the high prices that Iowans pay at the pharmacy. An issue of this scale requires strong bipartisan policies that rein in the anti-competitive practices of drug companies and promote a fairer, more affordable drug market. Right now, there are bipartisan efforts in the U.S. Senate to promote legislation that reduces price gouging and patent manipulation. It is essential that both parties come together to advance this legislation, because every day that Congress waits, more and more Iowans will be stuck paying exorbitant prices at the pharmacy. Thankfully, our Senator Joni Ernst has never been afraid to work across the aisle to tackle the major problems harming Iowans, including the drug pricing crisis. She has always put the needs of Iowans above partisanship, and I have faith that she will stand with us now to bring down the price of our prescriptions in a bipartisan way. For too long, pharmaceutical companies have gotten away with gaming the system for their personal profit at the expense of Iowa patients. Ernst has the power to stop them. Next, from the New York Times contributor Jamel Bowie, the only question to ask about these House Republicans. The collapse of the House Republican majority into chaos is the clearest possible evidence that the party is off the rails. Of course, the Republican Party has been off the rails for a while now. This was true in 2010, when Tea Party extremists swept through the party's ranks, defeating more moderate Republicans, and pretty much any other Republican with an interest in the actual work of government, and establishing a beachhead for radical obstructionism. It was true in 2012, when many Republican voters went wild for the likes of Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, and Newt Gingrich on the party's presidential primary, before settling in on more conventionally presidential Mitt Romney. But even then, Romney reached out to Donald Trump, famous, politically speaking, for his birther crusade against President Barack Obama, for his blessing, yet another sign that the Republican Party was not on track. The truth of the Republican Party's deep dysfunction was obvious in 2013, when congressional Republicans shut down the government in a quixotic drive to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And it was obvious in 2016, when Republican voters nominated Trump for president. Everything that has followed, from the rise of influencer extremist politicians like Representative Lauren Boebert to the party's complicity in insurrectionist violence, has been a steady escalation from one transgression to another. The Republican Party is so broken at this point, its congressional wing cannot function. The result is that this period is now the longest the House of Representatives has been in session without a speaker. And as Republican voters gear up to nominate Trump a third time for president, the rest of the party is not far behind. The only question to ask and answer is why. One popular answer is Donald Trump, who, in this view, is directly responsible for the downward spiral of dysfunction and deviancy that defines today's Republican Party. It's his success as a demagogue and showman that set the stage for the worst of the behavior we've seen from elected Republicans. The problem, as I've already noted, is that most of what we identify as Republican dysfunction was already evident in the years before Trump came to the scene as a major figure in conservative politics. Even Trump's contempt for the legitimacy of his political opponents to the point of rejecting the outcome of a free and fair election has clear antecedents in the conservative agitation over so-called voter fraud, including efforts to raise barriers to voting for rival constituencies. Another popular answer is that we're seeing the fruits of polarization in American political life, and it is true that within both parties, there's been a marked and meaningful move away from the center and toward each side's respective flank. But while the Democratic Party is, in many respects, more liberal than it has ever been, it's also not nearly as ideologically uniform as the Republican Party. Nor does a rigid doctrinaire liberalism serve as a litmus test among Democratic voters in Democratic Party primaries outside of a small handful of congressional districts. Joe Biden, for example, is the paradigmatic moderate Democratic and currently the President of the United States and leader of the Democratic Party, with ample support across the party establishment. And in Congress, there's no liberal equivalent to the House Freedom Caucus, no group of nihilistic, obstruction-minded, left-wing lawmakers. When Democrats were in the majority, the Congressional Progressive Caucus was a reliable partner of President Biden's and a constructive force in the making of legislation. If the issue is polarization, then it seems to be driving only one of our two parties toward the abyss. Helpfully, the extent to which the Democratic Party still operates as a normal American political party can shed light on how and why the Republican Party doesn't. Take the overall strength of the Democratic moderates, who hold the levers of power within the National Party. One important reason for this fact is the heterogeneity of the Democratic coalition. To piece together a majority of the Electoral College, or to gain control of the House or Senate, Democrats have to win or make inroads with a cross-section of the American public: young people, affluent suburbanites, Black, Hispanic, and Asian American voters, as well as a sizable percentage of the white working class. To lose ground with any one of these groups is to risk defeat, whether it's in the race for president or an off-year election for governor. It is not simply that the Republican Party has politicians like Jim Jordan and Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's that the Republican Party is practically engineered to produce politicians like Jim Jordan and Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene. And there's no brake, no emergency off switch that might slow or stop the car. The one thing that might get the Republican Party back on the rails is a major and unanticipated shift in the structure of American politics that forces it to adapt to new voters, new constituencies, and new conditions. It's hard to imagine what that might be, and it can't come soon enough. Now here's the short one from the Storm Lake Times pilot editor Art Cullen, Killing Rural Iowa. We trust that our state legislators are paying close attention to the issues in area school and city locations and city elections coming up. No doubt, former Alta Aurelia Superintendent Senator Lynn Evans, Republican from Aurelia, is keenly aware of the difficulties the school board faces in trying to rearrange a class realignment that administrators believe will deliver instruction more efficiently and effectively. In this case, the issue is transportation, not enough bus drivers, which really is an issue of money. Schaller Crestland is looking at shutting down a building at Early, as its Ridgeview partner, Galva Holstein, has its own budget issues. It's a long haul from Nemaha to Holstein, and so on at Sioux Central and Lawrence Marathon. The governor claims a $1.83 billion surplus in the state budget and wants more income tax cuts. The legislature diverted hundreds of millions of dollars per year to vouchers for private school families that come out of the hide of K-12 public schools, like Newell Fonda, which shuttered the Fonda building not so long ago. The legislature controls school funding. School boards and superintendents are left to sort it out, like putting up walls to keep Alta Aurelia school children out of the Alta Public Library bookshelves. The governor got $2 million in tax cuts out of the legislature last session. The tax cuts look pretty sweet until you try to figure out how to get a Hinkle-D from Hanover to Alta and then Aurelia and back. Or do you just throw up your hands and ship them to Storm Lake or Cherokee? That's the issue underlying these elections. Consolidation is relentless. It has long been the effect, if not the goal, to create centrally located schools. The pressures are relentless, and set friendly neighbors Galva Holstein and Schaller Crestland against each other. Rural schools are magnets of community pride. They are under attack from the legislature and the governor. A lot of folks are running for school board to see what they can do. They are running to save their schools from a state government that does not respond to their real and pressing needs. Does everybody in Des Moines really care that Early will lose a school? Clearly, not enough legislators do. Do they care if Sioux Central or Ridgeview can hold things together? Not by legislative appropriations to transportation or buildings. Not when you siphon off funds so rich families get a break sending their kids to West Des Moines Dowling High. By extension, do these legislators care about Early or Schaller as healthy communities? Not much. They are just obstructions to a larger system that sees rural communities as a drain or an anachronism. That is a big part of what is wrong with Iowa. Strong rural schools made us unique. Small class sizes, lots of individual attention, teamwork, and pride. They make small communities more attractive and sustainable. We are not supporting what used to be our foundational strength. Outstanding education, no matter where you live, rural or urban in Iowa. Yet we are abandoning schools and whole towns as we scour for more tax breaks for the big money in Des Moines. Republicans controlling the state house draw their base from rural areas, yet they are actively participating in their plunder. It doesn't make much sense. Early voting is underway. Monday is the last chance to request an absentee ballot or pre-register. Dateline Waterloo. The deadline to pre-register for the November 7th election and request an absentee ballot is 5 p.m. on Monday. That's tomorrow. Early voting started Wednesday at the election office on the second floor of the Black Hawk County Courthouse, 316 East 5th Street. People can cast a vote anytime from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. on weekdays through November 6th. Quote, there haven't been any significant changes to early voting, but the absentee window has gone from 29 to 20 days, which is still a little new for voters, said elections manager Karen Showalter. Quote, when I first started here in 2016, it was 40 days. The absentee request and pre-registration can be completed online at blackhawkcountyelections.iowa.gov by clicking the red request form bar at the top of the window. A handwritten request will be accepted if it includes the following required information: full name, complete address, date of birth, ID number, date or name of election, voter's signature, and date the form was signed. The request can be dropped off at the election office or be mailed to 316 East 5th Street, Room 210, Waterloo, Iowa, 50703. However, it was recommended to do that by Thursday to ensure it gets to the office on time. No matter what time the absentee request is received on a given day, the ballot, by law, is required to be mailed out by the office that same day. As of Thursday, 500 voters have either requested to have an absentee ballot mailed to them or have voted absentee in person at the election office. The turnout for the 2021 city school election was nearly 30%, or 25,000 voters, of which 5,000 voted absentee. Absentee ballots can be turned in at the drop-off box outside the courthouse. It's available 24/7 and is checked 4 times per day, even weekends and holidays. They can also be mailed to the same address as the request form, 316 East 5th Street, Room 210, Waterloo, Iowa, 50703. Either way, the absentee ballots must make it to the election office by the time polls close at 8 p.m. on November 7th. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. It's Monday, October 23rd, and I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of today's reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.